talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leuten, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're investigating how Irish women and men have changed the way we think and redefine knowledge as we explore Ireland's journey through science, technology, engineering and mathematics. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. Across artificial intelligence, climate change, food safety, transport and communication, the fields of STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths are integral to modern society. In tonight's show, we want to celebrate the diversity of STEM in Ireland, and the show is inspired by the forthcoming publication of Irish STEM Lives, published by the Royal Irish Academy, which brings together 46 extraordinary lives from the Dictionary of Irish Biography, DIB.ie. And so to discuss the role of Irish women and men in science, technology and engineering across four centuries, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Eoin Kinsella is the managing editor of the Dictionary of Irish Biography and has written extensively on Irish history from the 17th century to the present. Professor Jane Grimson is a member of the Royal Irish Academy and a past president of Engineers Ireland and of the Irish Academy of Engineering. She is a fellow emerita and former vice provost of Trinity College Dublin, and she's the co-editor of Irish STEM Lives. Turlo O'Riordan is the online and digital editor of the Dictionary of Irish Biography. Over two decades, he's written biographical entries for the DIB on the areas of architecture, medicine, publishing, religion, science and sport. And he's the other co-editor of Irish STEM Lives. Well, you're all very welcome. And Eoin, I might begin with you, and I might begin with the Dictionary of Irish Biography in general, because I think in recent years it's really reached a whole new audience because it's open access, it's online, people can search for the entries. And then these volumes then, with their introductions, help bring it to a new audience again as well.
Yeah, let me give you, I suppose, the background or sort of a general overview of what the DIB is. We're a work of reference. We have about 11,000 biographical, almost 11,000 biographical entries on people who've led noteworthy lives in Irish history. And to qualify for, I suppose, entry in the DIB, you have to have been born in Ireland, born to Irish parents, or born outside of Ireland and had a significant career within Ireland. So that kind of is those are the basic criteria. So we cover the whole span of Irish history. We go from the earliest records right up to the present day. We cover people from sports through to politicians, from the arts through to education, every walk of life that you can conceive of, and from the earliest times to the present day. So that's the general overview. And I think with this series called the Irish Lives series, and this volume is the third volume in that series, what we're trying to do is give people a curated or a selected way into the DIB, because when you land on our website, you can, if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, you could be very quickly overwhelmed with the fact that there are 11,000 entries to look at. So with something like the first in this series was Irish Lives in America, we looked at people who'd had an impact in America. With Irish Sporting Lives, that's very self-explanatory. And now again with Irish STEM Lives, we're trying to just give people an entryway into the DIB, kind of give them a way of actually starting to explore, and a curated way of exploring the DIB itself, which, you know, like I said, it's a tool for students, but it's also a tool for just a general interested public, for academics. And we get a huge range of people who draw upon the DIB itself. It's very deliberate that we're trying to just look at slightly different aspects of Irish history and of people who've lived and created, I suppose, a legacy that isn't very well known. So it's very easy to know about the Taoiseach, the most important political lives, but not so much about the sports. And certainly with this particular volume, when you look at people who worked in science, technology, engineering and mathematics, those lives are incredibly interesting. They've had incredible impact, not just in Ireland, but globally around the world. And what we're trying to do here is highlight those and spotlight those particular lives, because they're not as well known as a lot of them deserve to be. And that's part of the reason. And what Jane and Turlough have done is really brought together a collection of lives that highlights those achievements and those people and brings them, I think, we're hoping, into the spotlight just that little bit more.
Jane, it's a fantastic volume and a wonderful introduction by you and Thurlow. And I think one of the areas you bring out in the introduction is about how sometimes women are ignored or left out of these kinds of discussions. But actually, what you've been able to show is that this isn't just the story of Irish men. This is the story of Irish women as well, and women who made a very significant contribution despite the obstacles that they faced because of their gender in these areas.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for up until the 20th century, women didn't really have access to science education. So they were mostly home educated, and it tended to be in the arts, languages, music, that kind of thing, not really science. So the ones who actually managed to succeed in science usually had a father or a brother or an uncle who encouraged them and supported them. But even then, it was, as you say, very difficult for them to make a name for themselves in the man's world. And very often they published their work under somebody else's name, their father's name, their brother's name, rather than their own name. So they didn't always get the recognition that they should have got.
And it's important that women are included in it because, you know, young girls in school are inspired by examples that they see and that they hear and that they read about, and that it's important for people who will grow up to become scientists in their own right to see that there have been pioneers and trailblazers in science, in technology, in engineering and in mathematics.
Absolutely. It's really, really important. I did engineering originally, and people you'd talk to me about role models, and I used to feel slightly uncomfortable because it sounds like something you're up on a pedestal. But I've come to realise that the examples of people who have succeeded over the years, over the centuries, is just wonderful. It's such an encouragement.
And you were, I think, the first woman to be Vice Provost in Trinity.
I was.
And you were blazing your own trail there.
I was also the first woman to graduate in engineering from Trinity.
No way.
Yeah.
That is brilliant. And what was it like being the only woman in the class?
Oh, sure, it was grand. There were 30 guys. I ended up marrying one of them, so it was good.
So it all worked out okay. Thurlow, I always love with these collections asking the question, how did you decide who would go in? But what I also love is, how did you decide who to leave out?
Exactly. It's the eternal ongoing conversation. And I started work on the collection with Jane. We found there was over 600 lives in the wider Dictionary of Irish Biography, encompassing the sort of four STEM disciplines. And it was quite a bit of work to whittle them down to a long list, if you will, of around 100 or so lives. We definitely disagreed on certain lives, but we easily agreed on the lives we pulled together. And what was one of the important parts of these live series is we also have a look at the more recent scholarship and history and biographical work to highlight some new lives that wouldn't necessarily have come to our attention, and to bring those into the DIB. And it's also an opportunity to expand and improve our existing entries based on the same research where possible. But Jane came with a very well-founded aim to give due recognition to engineering and maths, which are often not undervalued but overlooked in the STEM conversation. And as the introduction shows and the collection shows, there's some really interesting women active in mathematics, astrophysics, astronomy in the 19th and 20th century who really weren't that well known. And then the great Mary Mulvihill, who is in the collection, one of the 16 women, she undertook foundational work as a STEM communicator, excavating many of the lives of the women STEM practitioners.
And Owen, there is one entry that perhaps might be controversial. He had a controversial life, certainly elements that have been uncovered in recent years, and perhaps a controversial inclusion, and that's Erwin Schrödinger. And, you know, people might be familiar with Schrödinger's cat, and he's someone who had a career in Ireland, but then scandal emerging in recent years.
Yeah, and this touches upon a couple of the things that Thurlow just mentioned as well in terms of the DIB's ability. Since we went online, and you mentioned this in your intro, that we've become open access and we're almost primarily an online publication now. And what that does is gives us really a huge amount of flexibility to update entries where they need to. Sometimes it's because there's been more recent scholarship, which gives us much more information about a particular life, and that allows us to go back, add in those details. And that, I think, helps us to stay relevant, and that's really important. Any work of reference, which the DIB is, has to be updatable if it wants to stay relevant. Otherwise, it will just descend into obsolescence. So that's one of the things that we're constantly on the lookout for. So when it came to Schrödinger, now the three of us had a discussion about whether or not we would include him, because Schrödinger, our entry on Schrödinger initially didn't have any discussion of his relationships with underage girls, which were, became, I suppose, more publicly known in around 2021, when there was an article in the Irish Times which talked about this in more detail that wasn't mentioned in our original entry. Now, Schrödinger's career was of such importance that we had a discussion, should we put him in this particular collection? But also we recognised that there was an opportunity here for us to update the DIB's entry. And we could do both. We could update the entry to reflect the sort of the more recent emergence of these very distasteful and, you know, just really difficult element of his, I suppose, his personal life. But we had to have them in his entry and in any discussion about him. And we wanted to bring him into this collection, not just because he was so important from a STEM perspective, but also because it actually gives us an opportunity to highlight the fact that we're updating our entries and we're taking into account all of these elements of a person's life and not just looking at their achievements, but we're also looking at their lives in the round and including all of the elements that, which would be difficult elements to discuss and difficult elements to include as well.
And he's included because he had that significant career in Dublin and in Ireland and played a significant role in Irish science at that time.
Yeah, he does. And he comes into Ireland just before the Second World War, and he's one of the influential people in the establishment and in the evolution of the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, which is one of our sort of premier academic research institutions as well. So he has an enormous impact in terms of the study of STEM and the STEM disciplines in Ireland in the 1940s and beyond as well. So he was somebody that we obviously is in the DIB and somebody that really needed to be included in this volume as well, but also just to make sure that we had the full picture of his life and gave people not just the achievements, but also the unsavoury elements as well.
And that's true of the DIB more broadly. And it's about showing the full entirety of Irish history.
Yeah, we do. We try to capture that whole scope. So we try to capture, obviously, the achievements, the noteworthy elements, but also the unsavoury elements, the dark side of Irish history and Irish lives as well.
Right beside, I think, that entry, or very close to it, is one on Harry Ferguson, Turlough. And Harry Ferguson and the tractors and the whole history there is, again, it's maybe an aspect and an angle that people mightn't expect to see in a volume like this.
Absolutely. He's such an interesting figure, not least because he built and flew the first lighter-than-air aircraft in Ireland. And he trained as a mechanic and he went on to develop cars and racing cars and then started to work on tractors based on his own upbringing on the farm. And he just developed a whole suite of approaches, engineering approaches, that are basically mirrored in all the tractors we see around the world today. But at a time when mechanization was very much on the edge of agriculture. And I saw one of his wee Fergie tractors this summer on a farm in Yorkshire and just got to thinking about them. And you'll see people driving them around at tractor rallies and so forth. I mean, people adore them because such things as making sure there was a standardized wrench and a standardized nut size so that it could be repaired very easily on the farm, but also really important mechanical engineering that meant that the PTOs and the interchangeable implements could be shared and bought. And just bringing the tractor to the small farmer around the world was just an amazing story, you know.
And he had a close and crucial relationship with Henry Ford, and that was so important for the production of the tractors.
Absolutely, and he was certainly an engineer more than a businessman. And then he teamed up with the Massey Company, and Massey Ferguson emerged from that. So there's quite a few lives in the book that touch on patents and intellectual property, and that's a whole different side of the, you know, the emergence of the industrial side of engineering and things. But yeah, the Ferguson life is a really wonderful life, and it's not something that gets widely celebrated, you know.
And it shows how, so you know, an engineering career can have, you know, these wider applications and impacts, and you know, we wouldn't necessarily think that we're going to find the person behind Massey Ferguson in a book about Irish STEM lives.
Absolutely. And it ties in with, if I may mention one or two other lives, I mean, agriculture, food production, what we take for granted now, you know, convenience, processed food. There's two wonderful lives. Another from Northern Ireland, Hilary Stevenson, who was a chemist who started to work on food safety. And her work on irradiation and, you know, the safe production of food was really, really important in the 1980s and 1990s. And she died a little younger than most, in her 50s, I think. So her kind of career is not well known, but it's absolutely essential to what we regard as modern food safety. And then John Martin Scott, who I'm sure Jane would have known, he was a fantastic medical researcher and biochemist, and he married the two disciplines in this incredible range of foundational work he undertook in Trinity College and also the Coombe Hospital, examining the B foliates and basically the importance of folic acid to maternal health and child rearing, and established that in a scientific way that was just so clear that the benefits could accrue to young children and mothers. So there's this sort of applied end of the spectrum in the lives we collected, and also the sort of underlying pure research, and they kind of marry in various lives like that, you know, from Ferguson right up to to young babies.
And Jane, it is interesting reading the entry for John Martin Scott. He only died in 2012, so it is very recent history. And it says in the entry about how Trinity established three fellowships, PhD studentships in his honour in biochemistry. And but that's you know, essentially, you know, history of our lifetimes there.
Absolutely. And we have a number of people who are most of us would have known, for example, in talking of Trinity again, John Byrne, who is regarded as the father of computing in Ireland. He was the first professor of computing in Ireland. He established a lot of degree programs in engineering and in computer science and in short courses. He came from a family with a strong tradition of public service. His great-grandfather and his grandfather were very involved as architects of public housing projects in Ireland. And I think this was very much part of John's upbringing and his philosophy. And therefore, when he started the computer science department, he was not only anxious to introduce undergraduate degrees, but also to introduce programs for people who are working in the public sector or in industry who wouldn't have had the opportunity to get qualifications in computing because they didn't exist. So he started a number of these short courses. He started one for teachers, and they were incredibly successful and had a significant impact. And the other area where John had a very important impact was with the IDA and Enterprise Ireland, who had a focus on trying to encourage IT companies, a very successful focus on encouraging IT companies to come to Ireland. And initially the focus was on hardware and manufacturing. Whereas John and some others felt that the future probably lay more in software and ICT services. And he encouraged the IDA and Enterprise Ireland to look at those areas. And we can see the result today with so many of the big international IT companies, the European headquarters being in Dublin. And I think John can take a degree of credit for that.
And he only passed away in 2016.
Yes.
So again, a very recent life. And I love the entry there. It also shows his outside interests beyond academia, genealogy, architecture, mathematics, history, particularly the history of computing, and that he left behind such an impressive collection of books and documents and slide rules and software that these were all donated to Trinity and became a part of the computer science collection.
That's right. And it's a fascinating collection because it goes back to early counting machines and abacuses and things like that, right up to modern computing devices.
And Jane, the whole idea of STEM and the STEM, when did that really emerge? And was there ever, you know, sometimes people like to talk about STEAM and they add in the arts to it. Is there ever an attempt by a discipline to say, actually, like genetics, we want to be a letter of our own. We don't want to be falling under the heading of science.
Yes, and I think that's true. The idea of science, technology, engineering and maths is American in origin, so it goes back to about the 60s. The acronym is much later, the 80s, 90s, the acronym of STEM. And now we tend more and more to talk about STEAM with arts in there as well. I think, though, the issue that we have today is a lot of knowledge discovery is getting more, and understandably, more and more and more specialised. So researchers are more and more focusing on narrower and narrower areas. So they don't want to be lumped in with STEM. They want to be in their own sort of niche area, whatever it is. And I think there's... I can see why it happens, because knowledge is getting more and more complicated and we're discovering, making more and more discoveries, so that we need these specialists. But if you look at the kind of problems that face our world today, whether it's climate change or energy or global health, all of these require heavily interdisciplinary solutions. And working with people from other disciplines poses all kinds of challenges because they have different ways of doing their research, different terminologies, different methodologies. And so it's quite a challenge. And I think as there is a tension between this increased specialization and the need for more interdisciplinary approaches. I think the most recent example of it is definitely in the pandemic. The pandemic required multiple disciplines to work together at breakneck speed, from the very basic scientists who were working with mRNA to the pharmaceutical companies that had to scale up using the skills of engineers to manufacture the vaccines really, really quickly. Speeding up the clinical trials requires a lot of specialist statistical support and so on. And then you get into logistics and distribution. But then if you look at the other side, so that's all kind of science and engineering, the STEM kind of areas. But if you look at the other side, it's very important to have behavioral scientists, psychologists involved. I mean, we now recognize that there were issues about schools being closed for long periods of time and the psychological impact of that. So the behavioral scientists, the psychologists, the economists, they all have something to contribute to the discussion and to the solution of a lot of the problems that we have today. So I argue strongly that STEM people need to be more open. They tend to, a lot of STEM people get very exercised over qualitative research, because quantitative, okay, that's numbers, that's grand. Qualitative research tends to pose problems and people can be a little bit doubtful about it. But we need to be much, much more open to these other approaches.
And Jane, do you think that looking at the 46 lives in the volume, there are some common characteristics that the people have? That were they all curious and determined and problem solvers, or is it just evidence that they all are different backgrounds, different types of personalities and people, and that it's maybe impossible to kind of pinpoint something that they all had in common?
I think it is difficult to pinpoint something that they all had in common. But I think perhaps the one thing that they do is a passion for what they were doing. I mean, I think they were all very passionate, whether it was William Parsons building the big telescope in Birr, or Emily Anderson and her work on, which has nothing to do with STEM, but her work on the letters of Mozart and Beethoven. They were very, very passionate about what they were doing. But they're very different. Most of the men would have had some scientific training, whereas the women had to be self-taught, and so they approached it from a different area. And also for the women, there were areas that they couldn't really realistically work in, you know, that involved a lot of laboratory work.
Very good.
I didn't have access to it.
And we will talk a little bit later about Emily Anderson and her brilliant code breaking. But Turlough, what about you? Did you think that there was any kind of characteristic or a quality that they had in common? Was there something that you could maybe almost pinpoint at an early stage and say, oh, I can understand now why they had such a successful career in STEM?
I think looking at some of the lives, definitely patterns emerge with the inventors and some of the scientists. They really were, you know, dogs with something in their mouth. They ran after something for a long time and worked really hard to develop it. So Ferguson and his tractor, definitely, even more so with John Holland and the invention of the submarine. It's something he developed really from early in his life in a private capacity as a math teacher, and then took to America and ended up underpinning the kind of US naval submarine fleet. But I think it comes back to the opportunities that arise to do with, say, family background or educational attainment. So One or two things that only occurred to me in recent days was there's two really important scientists from the late 20th century, Dan Bradley and John Bell. They both entered academic research through the vocational route in their early 20s, essentially as mature students, and became world-leading physicists. I mean, it's quite striking. Jane touched on there the opportunities for women being so limited. That meant that they tended to cluster in mathematics, astrophysics, public science, and also in the 20th century, we have two crystallographers, Helen Meagher and Kathleen Lonsdale. And there's a whole area of research there that examines this question of why women went into those fields and what opportunities spurred them and what interests they had. It looks like crystallography very early on in the mid-20th century was much more egalitarian and open-minded as a formal scientific discipline for whatever reasons. To go back to the driving force, I mean, you've got Boole's obtuse, deep logical algebra that gave rise to to Claude Shannon's information theory, which is just foundational. I'm no expert on William Rowan Hamilton, but his great moment of insight. There's a little bit of that in some of these lives. They must have been incredibly deep thinkers, and
your book begins with that in the introduction. That story of that moment, that flash of inspiration at the bridge.
Yeah, and every time I see the bridge, I think of it, and I won't claim to understand Quaternions, but they are really important in kind of visual graphics nowadays and artificial intelligence. And you know, the lives capture so much over four centuries that they span from Robert Boyle right up to the late 20th century. I think for the 16 women we collect, there is a unifying feature, which is the just intrinsically enormous barriers socially, educationally, familiarly placed in front of them. So their achievements have to be taken into consideration in that regard. I'm really drawn to one or two lives, and Percy Ludgate in particular, this lone genius, this unheralded accounting clerk working in an accountancy firm in Dublin, developing a really important computational concept entirely on his own and dying unknown as well. And that touches on what Owen's talked about, which is this ongoing unearthing of new evidence that relates to some of the lives in the dictionary, and including Percy Ludgate in the collection of STEM lives, gave us an opportunity to expand the entry based on some incredible scientific and genealogical research done by people working on him. So it's an ongoing conversation. But yeah, he really, I often wonder about him. You know, I just what was the moment where he came up with this incredible singular idea of what a computer could be, which turned out to be used by IBM in a 1960 patent case to protect their own intellectual property. So it did have a huge contribution, you know.
And it shows, the article shows about how a piece that he wrote in 1909 was utilized for a 1960 bid that IBM were involved in about the development of the computer. So he's very much, as he's described, a pioneer of computing.
Absolutely. And that case was really not known about in the English-speaking world until a couple of years ago, because it was undertaken in the German courts. And it's fascinating. I mean, IBM had a lot to protect. And by showing what Ludgate had essentially invented, they were able to stop somebody else getting a patent on their gold dust, the idea of a computer, you know.
So someone who died in October 1922 was actually a major pioneer. And so in a way, Owen, these are stories that some are well known, some are known by people who are maybe specialists in the area, but they're not more widely known. People don't know that John Hollins was the inventor of the submarine. I'd never heard of Percy Ludgate before. That there are these wonderful stories, but they really aren't really as known or as celebrated as they should be.
Yeah, and I think one of the brilliant things about this particular volume is that, it, first of all, it brings those together, but what the DIB does in general and what this volume kind of distills into 46 lives is it gives you these stories of these people's achievements, their lives in general, in a way that's so accessible, you know, because these are written by academic experts, by subject experts, but they're written in a way to make it as readable and as accessible as possible. So they're useful to academics, of course, but they're also something that will give you a lot of information about people that you've never heard about before. And picking up on some of the themes that sort of Turlough and Jane have been talking about, their introduction also, part of this series, is it gives us a chance to put together an introductory piece of writing, which actually encapsulates a few of the trends and the themes that are within the DIB that we don't get a chance otherwise to do. So their introduction has done this brilliant job of tying together all these lives, which span about 400 years in total of history, from the early 17th century right up to 2020, which I think is the death of the most recent life that we have within it. But they do draw upon things like the importance of class in terms of giving people opportunities to explore their careers or develop their careers, especially in the 19th century. And a class is very important for women, and as well as the social barriers that they have. So that's one thing. And also then, like as Turlough said, having actual opportunities to go to university, having opportunities to pursue the intellectual dreams that you might have. And taking somebody like Robert Boyle, who's the first entry in the volume, he's born in the early 17th century. And he's one of those people who has this incredible array of interests, and just touches upon what Jane is saying about inter and intradisciplinarity, and how then you can trace almost that specialization, that increasing specialization, through the volume itself. As we move through the 18th and 19th centuries, you see people are slowly but surely increasing their focus onto specific areas. And then by the end of the volume, you have people who are absolute geniuses in their fields. And we look at how that is, I suppose, an evolving process across those 400 years. So it kind of, you know, the volume itself just gives you a way of exploring a whole different wide range of of lives and experiences, and it's just really nicely done. And the selection process that Jane and Turlough did really gives us that opportunity to kind of see that really wide-ranging kind of array of lives that are within the DIB.
And I like the fact that it isn't in alphabetical order, like the original published dictionary of Irish biography is, because it's done in the chronological, so you get the sweep of the development and how science is progressing and how these lives are changing things and how the world is changing around them.
Yeah, and you know, I suppose Turlough and Jane would probably speak to this a bit more, but I know, again, when we were thinking about how to gather, so they made the selection, and then you think, well, how do you gather these together? Do you group them by disciplines, or do you group them by science, by technology, by engineering, by mathematics, or do you group them alphabetically, or do you group them by chronology? And it was Turlough and Jane who came up with chronology, and I think it was their intention was just to show that change in the way that we've investigated knowledge or pursued knowledge over the last 400 years, and it works really wonderfully. And I always worried that it would be quite difficult to follow, but no, it actually flows beautifully when you start with Robert Boyle and you finish with Anne Kernan, and you just have this incredible range of stories in between.
Well, we're going to take a quick break now. We are talking about Irish STEM lives, and when we come back, we'll be finding about polymaths and also about the influence and impact of Birr Castle. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Irish STEM lives. Tonight's show is inspired by the forthcoming publication of Irish STEM Lives by the Royal Irish Academy. It brings together 46 extraordinary lives from the Dictionary of Irish Biography. The editors are Professor Jane Grimson and Turlough O'Riordan. And Jane Grimson and Turlough O'Riordan join me on the show tonight together with Dr. Owen Kinsella, who's the managing editor of the Dictionary of Irish Biography. And Jane, can we talk about polymaths? Because what's really fascinating and in the volume is the number of people who are brilliant at many things.
Yes, and I think part of the reason, if you look back in the early days, part of the reason was that knowledge was not quite so compartmentalized. So the hard distinction between physics and chemistry, let's say, those distinctions were much more blurred. And so people worked more across disciplines, perhaps, than they do now as knowledge has expanded. And many, many of the lives illustrate incredible multidisciplinary knowledge, skills and expertise. And not just in the STEM areas. I mean, many of them were superb linguists, for example. Emily Anderson, for example, was a superb linguist. She was also a superb musicologist, as well as being a brilliant codebreaker. John Tyndall is another example. He had expertise in engineering, physics, chemistry, and so on. He investigated gases. He worked on meteorology and infrared analysis and spectroscopy. And he basically, his work has led to the identification of what is now known as the greenhouse effect. And he talked about light pipes, which is a kind of precursor to fiber optics. So he worked across a whole range of disciplines. Emily Anderson did, and so many of the others did. I think one of the interesting things now, I mentioned before about increased specialization. We've heard a lot in recent years about AI and the development of AI. Well, artificial intelligence itself has to be very multidisciplinary. So you have expertise in linguistic analysis, you have expertise in language models, you have expertise in the structure of language, statistical methods and computing, and all these have to come together in order to develop systems like ChatGPT. I discovered, interestingly enough, this morning that one of the people who was involved in the development of AI, Jeffrey Hinton, has become somewhat nervous, concerned about the ethics of AI. And I learned this morning that he was a great-great-grandson of Boole. So there must be something in the genes there that he carried forward. So this polymath interdisciplinary is very much part of the historical development of STEM, and is perhaps becoming a little bit less common now.
And, you know, I have the PDF of the book here, Turlough, so I'm able to do my searches for phrases. So I was looking up artificial intelligence there, and it appears in a number of entries, including the entry on our friend Percy Ludgate.
Yes.
Who died in, 1922, and showed how some of the work that he was involved with and these types of calculations is used and was used for the development then of things like artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. And it goes back to what drove some of these individuals. I mean, Ludgate was incredibly smart, but he was working as an accounts clerk, but he had great mathematical ability, great logical ability, and it must have driven him to think about how he could undertake such calculations required of his work at scale in a faster way. So his novel device was to basically undertake addition, subtraction, multiplication and division in a faster, more organized way. But that underpins all computing. And similarly, there's an amazing woman in the collection, Kay McNulty, who is just one of these fascinating women who gained a bachelor's in mathematics in America, then worked in the School of Engineering, I think in the University of Pennsylvania, as what was called a computer, a role relegated to women, which was undertaking calculations for engineering, artillery and other kind of complex processes. But she happened to be there when they were forming a team to work on what became the first general purpose computer. And her contribution was enormous. We undertake things nowadays without thinking about them in all roles of life. And same with coding. And coders very early on in Kay's time, we're starting to think about how you describe a process to a machine, to a computer. And she came up with the idea of subroutines. And that's just another foundational impact. And everything is built on top of everything else in kind of the computer science and the computational thinking world. So AI reaches right back towards all of these people in so many different ways.
And we've mentioned Emily Anderson a lot, and you co-wrote that entry with Linda Lunny, and it builds on that wonderful biography by Dr. Jackie Kiona, Queen of Codes, and we've had her on the show talking about it. And you mention her in the introduction because I think she helped provide images for Emily and for Mary Goff. And the story of Emily Anderson, it is an extraordinary one. Someone who's able to play such a significant role in code breaking and during the Second World War. And it shows how these lives, they have an impact that goes far beyond our islands and far beyond just questions of science and technology. It's also to do with the kind of world and the future that we had.
Absolutely. And that biography of Emily Anderson is an incredible piece of historical research, because we knew about her as a musicologist, but no one really knew about her wartime career in code breaking and intelligence. But the skills in the way Jane talked about, they overlap and represent each other. So her amazing ability as a linguist brought her into contact with code breaking, but she used the same skills in her musicology work on the letters of Beethoven and Mozart, deciphering their own cryptic use of symbols and language in their letters. And they're all of the one, really, when you look from this reserve. But it's one of the most interesting, original source materials we've come across, that body of work. And I think it just shows you what, again, interdisciplinarity, being aware of what others are undertaking, can just bring new insights. And as historians, we need to think about that as well, with digital methods and the digital humanities, and also with a certain amount of caution and context and looking beyond our own areas sometimes, you know.
And Jane, Burr Castle features quite prominently as well, and incredible in terms of astronomy and also the number of lives that have connections there, including Mary Ward, who lived in the early part of the 19th century and is down as a microscopist, astronomer, artist and author, and who played a significant role in all of those areas, but also has that crucial Burr connection.
Yes, I think it's fascinating to think that in the 19th century, Burr, the cluster of STEM activity around Burr was actually internationally renowned. We tend to think of Ireland, famous Irish writers who've won Nobel Prizes and so on. We don't tend to think of Ireland as being a brilliant place for STEM. But Burr Castle, definitely in the fields of astronomy, engineering, photography and botany, had a cluster of individuals, starting mainly with William Parsons, who was the third Earl of Ross in the 1800s. And he built the Great Leviathan Telescope at Burr Castle, which I'm sure most people have seen. That was an amazing feat of engineering and astronomy. He worked with Thomas Grubb to actually build the Leviathan, and Grubb had started in Rathmines, a foundry in engineering works, developing high precision optical equipment and so on. So he was a natural partner for William Parsons to build this telescope. It was also important in terms of the support structure for the telescope. The telescope itself and all the tube and everything weighed several tons. So actually being able to support it so that you could move it to look at different parts of the sky was very important, move it smoothly. So that was quite a complex thing. And William's son, Charles Parsons, invented the steam engine. Thomas Grubbs, his son, Howard, continued his father's work. And I think it was one slightly quirky coincidence that the fathers, Thomas Grubb and William Parsons, were both born in the same year, in 1800. And their respective sons, Howard and Charles, died in the same year, 1931, which is sort of slightly strange.
Oh, and the final entry in the volume is Anne Kernan. She died in 2020 and she was a particle physicist. And there's a wonderful entry by Tara Shears. Yeah. And it really does capture her remarkable life, her career with CERN, and the incredible contribution she made, and how she was not only in the right place at the right time, as I think one of the people said, she was able to really help conceptualize and reshape all of this work that was happening.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a bit of a skill as well, to be in the right place at the right time. And it's something that she demonstrated throughout her career. Like you said, she was a particle physicist, and she's born in 1933 in Glasnevin, and she goes to the Dominican College on Eichel Street specifically so that she can study physics, which she takes then into her undergraduate degree in UCD in the early 1950s. And I think Jane probably relate to this. She was the only woman in her class studying physics, and she went on to do her PhD in physics as well at UCD. And by the early 1960s, she's got a Sir Optimus Foundation fellowship to travel to America, where she joins the department at University of California in Berkeley, and then moves to the University of California in Riverside, where she becomes the first woman academic to gain tenure and becomes the first woman to become a full professor by 1970. So she's studying, when she was in UCD, she worked with the Nuclear Emulsion Group at Knurlsford Terrace. So she follows her interest in experimental physics right through to when she joins CERN in 1973. And she stays there for on and off the next two decades. And it's there really that her work sort of, I suppose, goes to the next level. And she's involved in the discovery of the W and Z bosons. And as well as that, then later on in the top quark. Now, the W and Z bosons are very important in terms of establishing the heavy force, which is one of the four fundamental forces of physics. I'm outside my scope of expertise here, so bear with me. And then she's also involved in the discovery of the top quark, which is a fundamental particle of matter. So two like incredibly important discoveries. She's part of the teams that make both of those discoveries, and she's invited to the Nobel Prize award ceremony in 1990s when I think it's Carlo Rubbia who leads the discovery of the W and Z bosons, but she's part of the team that actually worked on that as well. So she has this incredibly important career as in experimental physics and at CERN for almost two decades, and like I said, is one of the top particle physicists in America as well, and has that career as well. But what really struck me about her life was Tara Shears in Liverpool did an incredible job putting together the entry for us. And I was looking it up a little bit as well, and trying to follow her through the newspapers and say what kind of report and what kind of publicity did Anne have when her work was underway. I think she's mentioned twice in Irish newspapers across the entire span of her career. And that just struck me as somebody who's doing such incredible work and such important work and foundational to experimental particle physics. And she's just not getting any recognition within her home country. And she has connections. She retains her connections with Ireland all through. She establishes a bursary, I think, in the Dominican College in Eccles Street in 2007 for academic excellence in the pursuit of science for the secondary school students there. So she has this real connection back to her home country, and she maintains contact with her family the whole time. So, but just to see that lack of interest here in terms of her achievements and in terms of her her career really struck me. So I was delighted when we were able to include her in the volume, and that the life itself or the entry itself is so wonderfully, you know, it just captures her career and her life so well.
And she didn't give up, because there's a wonderful description of how she was tasked with developing this small detector, or some kind of detector for these quarks. And she estimated or calculated that she only had a 1 in 100 chance, because it wasn't very well funded. They were given an unrealistic time frame. Now, she was right, they weren't able to discover it, but she didn't give up. She went on to the next project, she kept working, she kept fighting for it, and she succeeded.
She did succeed in the end, and a lot of the work that she did, she was given what you would have called an unrealistic time frame to discover, I think it was help work at the top quark at this age, and she's given an unrealistic time frame, but she still went at it with her team. And I think the work that they did was then obviously incredibly important in terms of laying the foundations for the discoveries that followed. But she had that incredible knack as well of gaining funding. And I think that's a power that that it helps to keep those kind of projects alive. And one of the reasons why she was brought on board, not just for her actual expertise and her knowledge, but also because she had that ability to straddle that world between academics, but also bureaucracy. And it's a skill that most academics need at some point in their career. So yeah, I the kind of person who was brought on board for a whole variety of reasons, primarily for her particle physics expertise, but also for having that knack for being able to bring in the funding as well.
Okay, well, we are talking tonight about Irish STEM lives. We're going to take a quick break now, and we'll be back with more ingenious inventors and other great Irish STEM lives. So stay with us here on News Talk. Well, welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Irish STEM lives. My panel of experts: Dr. Owen Kinsella, the managing editor of the Dictionary of Irish Biography; Professor Jane Grimson, member of the Royal Irish Academy and a past president of Engineers Ireland and of the Irish Academy of Engineering, and she's the co-editor of Irish STEM Lives, published by the Royal Irish Academy; and Turlough Reardon, the online and digital editor of the Dictionary of Irish Biography and the other co-editor of Irish STEM Lives. Turlough, let's talk about again some of these remarkable people, ingenious inventors, incredible scientists, some remarkable people who went through perhaps different routes to make that valuable contribution. And you see it especially in the contributions of some of these really significant women, people like Mary Gough.
Yeah, Mary Gough is a fascinating figure. She came from really quite humble agricultural origins near Kilmore in County Wexford, and emigrated as a young adult with a number of young women to Texas with the intention of joining a Catholic religious order, the Sisters of Charity of the Incarnate Word congregation there. They specialised in teaching, as many did, and she took a BA in mathematics in 1920. She worked in various schools around Texas and Missouri, but then also took an MA in 1923, and then took a PhD at the Catholic University of America in 1931. And she's the first Irish woman we know of to have taken a PhD in mathematics. This was in the service of education. She went on then to work in what were called four-year college courses, sort of junior college around the Midwest region. But her life story is absolutely fascinating, especially when you compare it to, say, Sheila Tinney, who was a really important mathematician in 20th century Ireland, who came from much more privileged and well-resourced life. So, you know, for Mary Gough to have been awarded the PhD in such circumstances, when you look at her origins, is really quite something. And it speaks to the battles that just to get somewhere people have to undertake.
You know? And you wrote that entry, and you write about how she never returned to Ireland, and you discuss emigration and about how it was kind of forced upon her because of the poverty and the very difficult circumstances, and about how this was a story of overcoming all of those odds and obstacles.
Absolutely. And, you know, the economic context of so many of these lives, people had to leave Ireland for various reasons, even prestigious scientists and other STEM practitioners, to gain tenure, so to speak, at a university or undertake their research careers. But for Mary Gough, there really was no other option in the kind of the dire 1920s or the 1910s from a small farming background. But yet her life shows that providing education is a great enabler, as you know, we've all been lucky enough to study. And it can just open up opportunities that weren't there in the first place, you know, and it's important in the context. Gough might not jump out as an obvious choice, but we felt she sort of represented an alternate stream, and representing a woman in the religious life as well, which is really interesting, and also the compassion of teaching and service in that regard. And, you know, there's a whole group of interesting women mathematicians in the collection as well, you know.
Jane, I love the entry on Mary Mulvihill, and it gives her a description as science communicator, but she really had such an extraordinary career in communicating and in informing people and educating people, and in a way inspiring people about some of these remarkable stories and remarkable breakthroughs.
Yeah, she was very, very passionate. Interestingly enough, she went to an all-girls school, but she had a great interest in science, and she wanted to study chemistry at the Leaving Cert. So we're talking about the late 70s here. She had to go to the local Christian Brothers school in order to study chemistry. She then went on and did genetics in Trinity. She worked for a while with An Fáras Ta Iontais, and then switched to her career in journalism. And she edited the magazine Technology Ireland for quite a number of years. And she was also involved in science programmes that were absolutely meant for what we would tend to call popular science today, but with her sense of humor, she came up with wonderful titles for her various programs. There was Up and Atom, there was Chopped, Pickled and Stuffed, which of course is about the Dead Zoo, Washed, Peeled and Dried, that's about the Botanic Gardens. I just think the titles are so clever and very catchy. She was a very keen cyclist, and she presented a documentary entitled Pedal and Pebbles, which was a geological tour of Dublin by bicycle. She also did walking tours around Dublin with history of scientific figures, it was very fascinating. She was a founder member of Women in Science and Technology, WITS, which is still going today, and it brings together women working in STEM across all areas, so industry, business, public sector, universities. And the whole idea of WITS is to attract and retain more women in STEM. This was something that Mary was absolutely passionate about, and championing the importance of greater diversity in STEM. When she started WITS, she edited, she used she brought her journalism skills to bear with WITS, and she edited two collections of essays on women scientists. One, again, with rather catchy titles, Stars, Shells and Bluebells, Women Scientists and Pioneers. And another one, Lab Coats and Lace, The Lives and Legacies of Inspiring Irish Women Scientists and Pioneers. But probably her most important and significant publication was Ingenious Ireland, which is a biography, county by county, of very important Irish scientists. And it's still very widely used as a reference work today. She died very young, tragically. But she was an amazing science communicator, fantastic.
And brilliant at championing our science heritage, and also about showcasing the importance and significant careers of Irish women scientists that people wouldn't have been aware of.
No, exactly. And many of them people had never heard of. And she brought them out, brought them to the fore. It was amazing. She was an amazing woman.
Just on that, I mean, those two books were foundational in the kind of compilation and publication of the DIB, and it's really the cornerstone
of
women's
STEM.
Like, it's quite an achievement, you know,
yeah.
And it's great she's in the volume.
And Owen, the book is going to be launched by someone who is one of our brilliant current scientists, Aoife McLysett, the remarkable geneticist, but also currently the government science advisor. And that's going to be in October. There's going to be a panel discussing it at the Dublin Festival of History. So it's a way of showing how this is a story that is very much part of our present and our future as well, that we have remarkable women and men continuing to make these great strides and advances in science, technology, engineering and mathematics.
Yeah, which is very important to us to have that link to the present day and to the work that's going on at the moment. And like you said, Turlough and Jane are going to have a talk in the Royal Irish Academy before the launch itself. So people are more than welcome to come along to that as part of the Dublin Festival of History. And then we'll launch the book.
So, Owen, the final question, what's next?
Well, we've a couple of different ideas. We're hoping to bring out Dramatic Irish Lives at some point in the future, and Notorious Irish Lives, which is kind of deal with some of the more sketchy, shady past of Irish history. And there's a couple of other areas as well. So we're very privileged in that we get to work with our colleagues in publications in the Royal Irish Academy, who've done a wonderful job with this book in terms of the production of the book and helped us through the process. And we're hopeful that we'll be able to continue the series for the next few years. And we've lots of, I mean, like I said, there's 11,000 lives to choose from, and lots of different ways that we can package them up for people to enjoy.
Okay, well, that Dublin Festival of History event is taking place in the Royal Irish Academy on the 8th of October at 6 p.m. So just go to the Dublin Festival of History website or the Royal Irish Academy website, and you can find out more details about that. And the book will be going on sale in October. It's called Irish STEM Lives. It's published by the Royal Irish Academy. My thanks to my brilliant panel, Dr. Owen Kinsella, the managing editor of the Dictionary of Irish Biography. You can find out more, just go to the website dib.ie. Professor Jane Grimson and Turlough O'Riordan. Well, that does bring us to the end, as I say, of another edition of Talking History. My thanks as well to my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We have more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.